This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking this time with 93-year-old B-17 pilot and ex-prisoner of war, Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California, originally from Duluth, Minnesota. And where we left off in his World War II story, he was in Germany, shot down in his B-17, captured, and we just heard about when he was taken to a location where 50 or 60 other POWs were there. He found all but one member of his crew there. And I know you hadn't known any of these guys very long at all, but I have to imagine it meant something to you to see some familiar faces and also know that these men you felt responsible for had actually survived.
Well, it was a relief to see them, you know, realize that they had got out and landed safely and were in good hands, like I say, except the co-pilot.
When did you find out what happened to him?
Well, after the capture, we ended up on a train to Oberursel, which was an interrogation center, then for about a week, then to a place called Wetzlar, which was a place where all of the Air Force prisoner of war ended up as a sort of a distribution center. And after about a week there, you were either sent to Stalag 1 or Stalag 3. Like I say, all of the crew except the co-pilot. About 6 weeks later, a young captain that was in the bed next to me came into the camp. And when he saw me, he said, "Who was the first man out of your airplane?" I said, "The co-pilot." And he said he fell out of his chute. And that's the first time I knew what happened to him. It was a tragedy.
And when you hear something like that, do you say, that could have been me? That could have happened to any of us, the way it happened to him?
Well, it could, but in the routine, normally flying, like in the States when you're doing training, you unhook the leg straps on your parachute because they're confining. But in the wartime situation, you know, you don't do that. But what happened is the co-pilot did that. So he bailed out without his leg straps on. No, I didn't know that until I found out he fell out of his chute. And, of course, obviously that's what he did. He was flying without his leg straps yet. And he went to bail out. He forgot about it, unfortunately.
And you said that was his 25th mission and he would have gotten to come home?
Yeah, that was his 25th mission. And if he'd had his leg straps buckled, he would have made it. Tragedy.
And you mentioned interrogation, and I've heard a lot of different kinds of stories about those interactions with the Germans, and it seems everyone was a little surprised by how well, A, the Germans spoke English, and how much they knew about you. Is that what you found?
Oh, yeah. When we got to Oberursel, which was where they did the interrogations, we just spent a couple of days in there in solitaire, nobody talking to you, and you're wondering what's going to happen next, and then you start in the interrogations. And, of course, the first thing you do is, you know, your instructions are don't tell them anything. But after the first couple, 3 days, maybe about the fourth or fifth day, when I go in for about my third interrogation, the German, the captain that was interrogating me, told me where I graduated from flying school, where I was born and raised, what group I was with. In fact, he even told me the bed that I slept in my barracks in England. So they had an awful lot of information on people.
That sounds like it had to be pretty mind-blowing for you to realize that.
It was, and of course that's a technique they use to get you to figure that they know everything anyway, you know. Then it's something to get you to talk. Of course, I'd only been in England for about 5 weeks. And hell, I couldn't tell them anything that they didn't know anyway, and they soon figured that out.
So, shot down in September of 44, and interrogated, taken to the prison camp, Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany, near the Baltic Sea. As I try to, again, imagine myself in your shoes, it seems like a pretty uncertain future. How did you deal with that, with not knowing how long the war's going to last, with if you're ever going to be free again, if you're ever going to see your wife again? How did you cope with all of that?
Well, we were very confident. Actually, when I got to Stalag Luft 1, the war on the ground had been going pretty well. So I thought, well, it's no problem. We'll be home by Christmas. We all felt that the war was going in the right direction and that it would end soon. Of course, as we got close to Christmas, that's when they had there was a big Battle of the Bulge, I think they called it, and it became pretty apparent that we were going to be there a little bit longer. But we were confident, absolutely, that we were going to get out of there in not too far distant future. You know, as the months went on and it got into April and May, we knew the war was coming to an end. Our spirits were pretty good. We were confident we'd be out of there shortly. And, of course, we were.
And I'm guessing you knew that not because of what you were hearing from the guards and from the Germans. I'm sure they had a very different story to tell you about what was unfolding in the war. How did you get the truth?
Somewhere along the line, we had a hidden radio. And the way it got there is that various people on crews all had radio parts in their chutes and on their person. So that over time, enough of that got through that we had a radio that could listen in and get BBC. And with that information, the guys that worked in the administrative quarters ended up publishing a one-sheet newsletter every day that was passed from compound to compound. And then it got passed from building to building and room to room. So that sometime every day we got a piece of news that was from our side and not from the Germans.
And I'm sure the Germans were intent on confiscating that radio when they figured out you had one, huh?
Well, I think they knew that we had that, but I don't think they ever found it. To my best of my knowledge, I'm not just sure we hid the thing, but there were people in each barracks and in each compound that were responsible for it. But to best of my knowledge, I think the Germans knew that we had something going on, but I don't think they ever found one, at least not that I know about.
And did you ever have things that you needed to hide from the Germans? If so, how'd you do that?
Well, I never had anything I had to hide from them. Never got anything. People did, though. There were things going on. In fact, each barracks and so on had certain people. In fact, my roommate, Jerry Johnson, was the group intel officer, and he was privy to all the stuff that was going on. We had a lot of information that the Germans never knew we had. They suspected that there was a lot going on, but I don't think they ever found anything.
One of the other common themes that I end up discussing with every prisoner of war I've encountered is the diet and the weight loss. Now, you were a pretty big, strong guy. I've seen these photos of this bomber pilot. How much did you weigh when you were captured?
Oh, I probably weighed about 185.
And how hard was it to get used to the food you got in Stalag Luft 1?
Well, the Germans gave you enough to barely keep you alive, but we got what we call Red Cross parcels, which were furnished by the U.S. government, and by agreement with the Germans, were delivered to Switzerland and to Sweden. And then the arrangement with the Germans were that they could let those red parcels into us, and we generally got one a week. Basically, that's what kept us alive. Because our ration from the Germans was like a potato and a cup of barley a day, and that was it. We'd have starved if it hadn't been for the Red Cross parcels. We still all lost weight. When the war ended, I was probably down to about 155.
And that's not bad compared to some of the other extreme cases I've heard about. And you mentioned the Red Cross parcels. I'm sure that makes you a fan of the Red Cross still today. But what about the bread? You didn't say anything about the bread. Everyone tells me about the sawdust bread. Did you chip a few teeth on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got that piece of bread every day.
How hard was it? I've heard differing stories of how much was flour and how much was tree flour in the sawdust.
Yeah, I think it was probably about a quarter to a third sawdust. But, you know, we were so short of food, we ate it anyway. But if we had to depend on that and an occasional potato, why, we'd have all starved to death.
And what was it that kept you thinking positive, believing that you're going to come out of it? Where do you think that spirit, that mindset came from for you?
Well, we were confident, absolutely, that we were overcoming them, that the Germans were on the run. And I guess part of it was because of this, radio we had and the little newspaper that got circulated, so that we were pretty well aware of how the war was going. So we were confident that we were going to get out of there, before long.
And I saw in your scrapbook a postcard that you sent to your wife. Did you ever get any mail from her? Did you have any idea whether she knew you were alive or dead or safe or anything?
Yes, I got the only letter I got there was from her sister. So she told me that they had received a letter that I was shot down, and then a few weeks later that I was a POW. And got an address that way she could write to. And I got that letter from her sister. In the meantime, my wife wrote a letter to me, I guess every day, never got one. But when the war was over with, they were all sent back. And I don't know, God, there must have been 50 of them. And I read a lot of them when I was back home.
And before we get to you getting back home, if you spent all those months, 8 months as a prisoner of war, what was the hardest thing for you? What was the toughest thing to endure and overcome?
Oh, gee.
Because listening to you, it doesn't seem like it bothered you all that much. I don't know how much of that is time that's passed, but back then, I mean, you're still a pretty young guy, and this is some pretty tough stuff, it seems to me.
Well, the big thing is we were absolutely confident that the war was going in our direction and that we'd be out of there. We didn't know exactly when, but, well, initially when I got shot down, I thought I'd be home by Christmas, as I told you. So as things got a little bit grimmer, we realized that we were going to be there for a while, but we were confident that it wouldn't be too long, that sometime in the spring or summer, this thing was going to be over with. It was. We were right. The timing was a little off.
How was that Christmas, by the way? Christmas in captivity?
Well, that's no fun. Quite a few of the guys had been there long enough that they got parcels, through the mail, through the Switzerland and Sweden. A lot of them had food packages like cake mix and, stuff like that you could use. So one of the guys in our group had some of that, and we ended up making a cake.
No sawdust in that, right?
No sawdust in it. It wasn't much, but it was a break to have it, and a feeling that we've got something going here.
Boy, how much do so many of us take for granted, huh? We're out of time today for this episode of Hometown Heroes, but there is a lot more to Mr. Farwell's story, so we're going to pick it up again next time. Thanks to this 93-year-old ex-prisoner of war for helping to remind us so powerfully that freedom is not free.